Yeah.
User error.
Wasn't me, though.
Ooh.
I better not talk to you.
Yes, I understand. All right. You know, maybe that'll turn out to be best in the long run. So Corinth, of course, is a church that's obviously divided. We had talked about that in terms of their, you know, I am of Paul and Apollos and Cephas and so on. And yet the way a lot of people have approached this division is to kind of compare it to denominationalism. You've got Baptists and Presbyterians and Methodists. And there's no real indication that that's the problem at Corinth, that you've got this faction over here that's teaching one thing and behaving a certain way, and there's another faction over here that's quarreling with them and so on. All throughout the book, Paul simply addresses the church. You, this, you, this. And I don't suppose that means we must conclude that every single individual was guilty of every sin that the church is indicted for, but a sufficient number in the congregation are doing that, that you can collectively say this is what the church was doing, or this is the failing of them as a congregation. So they are divided. And if I had to guess or come up with a term that would address this, it seems to me that evidence would indicate that the Corinthians had a false notion of what it meant to be a spiritual person. They saw themselves as spiritual, that's clear. Their biggest evidence to them that they were spiritual beings was what, do you think? We've got to be spiritual because we've got something. What? The gifts of the Spirit. Do what? Oh, what did you say? But they did have spiritual, or at least some of them did, and this became a real badge of promoting themselves, exalting themselves. Apparently those that speak in tongues are better than others, and certainly anyone who had a gift was better than someone who had no gift at all. And, of course, what Paul is going to present then ultimately is what true spirituality is. And so if, again, we kind of read between the lines here and how they might have justified some of these things, how is it that a Christian, one who professes to follow Christ, could go visit prostitutes like they were doing in chapter 6, or they could take one another to court like they were doing earlier in chapter 6, or that they could so abuse the Lord's Supper and make it into this kind of self-centered activity. And on, all the failings of the Corinthians just pile up. Well, if you have this notion that, when you're a real spiritual person, it's almost like you're already living in heaven in some sense. And so what happens in this world in the here and now doesn't really matter as much as these higher kind of things. And that leads to a sense of elitism. We have wisdom. Others don't have wisdom. We have insight into this otherworldly spiritual realm, whereas they don't. And that then is obviously related to their problem they had with leaders. When we get to chapters 3 and 4, that's obviously going to be a big problem that they have. We've already seen it here in chapter 1 and verse 12. Each one of you saying, I'm of Paul and Apollos and Cephas. And just notice how often Apollos is mentioned in these first four chapters of 1 Corinthians. That's the first time, and of course mentioned with some other leader type of people here. And then we come to chapter 3, and he says in verse 4, when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not mere men? What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. You know, clearly what Paul is quoting here is the same problem that he had referred to back in chapter 1 and verse 12. This is an ongoing real problem. And notice verse 21. So then, no one must boast in men. And of course, you remember there's been a whole lot of condemnation by Paul of this problem of boasting. Back in verse 29 of chapter 1, no man should boast before God. It is written, if any man boast, he must boast in the Lord. And we know they had a problem with boasting, but when we get to chapter 3, verse 21, it's obvious that at least part of their problem of boasting was boasting in certain men. And then verse 22, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you. And so again, he's bringing up Apollos and himself again. And finally then in chapter 4, verse 6, these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that in us you might learn not to exceed what is written, in order that no one of you might become arrogant on behalf of the one against the other. And there is an idiom that's used by Paul that means, when he says the one and the other, he means Paul himself explicitly and Apollos explicitly, the ones that have just been mentioned in the text. And it's pretty clear that, by and large, Apollos came out looking and smelling a lot better than Paul did. And Paul was being the one disadvantaged and put down by the Corinthians. So this is a real problem that Paul's going to deal with. So in chapters 1 and 2, Paul's going to attack the fundamental problem at Corinth, which is this complete misunderstanding of what it means to be a Christian, a follower of Christ, to be a spiritual person. And then the related problem then of what that, how that affected their attitude toward those who were the leaders and so on. And so true spirituality is not some fantasy life in the future and somehow importing that into the present. It actually equips you to live in the present world. Christianity is not about escaping this world or finding some utopia that we can get away from the world. It is about learning how to live in this world, to control your conduct, to exercise self-control, things like that. And so that means humility, moral behavior, and this madness, this foolishness, way of living that Paul talks about in chapter 1, which we'll come back to. And of course, then your leaders then must be viewed, as he said, as servants. That's all they are, servants. Shane? Even the Gentiles wouldn't do that.
Yeah. So he's got his father's wife, which presumably his stepmother, in this case, we don't know.
No, that's the problem.
But even so, and they're bragging about this. You have to wonder, why would, it's the type of thing that normally a group of God's people, if that was going on, they either certainly wouldn't want the public knowing about it. If they weren't going to do anything about it, they certainly wouldn't, normally go around bragging about it.
Right. Right. It would be nice to know exactly how they justified that and in their own mind thought that was a good thing. And I do think for that reason it's a little difficult for us to relate to the Corinthians, because I've known a lot of bad congregations in my life, but I've not known of any that would condone going to prostitutes or worshiping at pagan idol temples or putting up with this incestuous relationship or whatever it is. But what we have to do, of course, is to make a corresponding application of this. Is it possible that we have false ideas about what real spirituality is? They may not be the same applications as the Corinthians did, but it's just as appropriate to apply the principle. And I certainly would say I've known a lot of Christians who had grossly misunderstandings of what it really meant to be a spiritual person. It might be something as basic as, I go to church all the time. And if you think that's your spirituality, you're woefully wrong, because that doesn't make you spiritual. There are plenty of people that never will miss when the door is open, but they're not spiritual people. And, there's just other kinds of applications we can think of. But Lawson?
Sexuality was a way of life. They just carried it over into the church.
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of these cultural, worldly things were infecting the church more than the church was having an influence on the world.
I could see how that could happen because we're facing that in our culture now, where tolerance of pretty decadent, immoral lifestyles are considered a good thing.
Right, right. That's true. Barry?
In another form, you know, similar things kind of happen in our society, like people that say, well, you know, I think Billy Graham has, you know, the most accurate view of the New Testament, or Oral Roberts is this, and they create these followings, and people follow after them and not really what they're teaching. They're just following after them. So your original comment about denominationalism, you know, it's almost a preamble to that, that people do start to follow after certain individuals instead of following after the teaching.
Right, right. And I do think this misunderstanding of the leaders, kind of looking for a celebrity hero worship thing, is that really is what a lot of the denominationalism is. And you see that in the fact that a lot of them wear the names of men to honor them. So. Right.
And they, well, what do you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's right. People are destined to want to follow men as right. opposed to ultimately following God.
Right. All right. Well, I, of course, I want us just to be thinking about this in the back of our mind as we go through the text, obviously. And that also, at least the way I would divide up the first four chapters here. I mean, clearly when we get to chapter 5, Paul begins addressing symptomatically the various issues that are in the church, whether he learned about them by some report from Chloe's people or Timothy or whoever, or this letter that the Corinthians have written to Paul that we know about from chapter 7. But clearly when we get to chapter 5, Paul starts tackling these various issues. And so where does that leave the first four chapters? Well, they're building the foundation of Paul's argument for what real spirituality is, and simultaneously demolishing the foundation of the false understanding of spirituality that the Corinthians have gotten themselves into. And so the church is divided because of this false wisdom, their false notion of what it means to be a Christian. What they are calling wisdom is not wisdom at all, but foolishness. And what they needed to adopt is the foolishness of God, and then they would be truly wise. And then chapters 3 and 4 are divided by this false leadership. So the problem is introduced to us in verses 10 through 17 of chapter 1, that they have this division and false wisdom and following after various men. And then the madness of God, the foolishness of God, this complete craziness of the gospel occupies Paul's attention from verse 18 through chapter 5 or chapter 2 and verse 5. And then the rest of chapter 2, Paul is going to say, now I've been bashing this wisdom, but there really is wisdom, true wisdom, but that is that wisdom that comes from God. So I'm not throwing all wisdom out. I'm for rhetorical effect, he's been calling the wisdom of God foolishness because that's how the world perceives it, not because Paul really does believe it is foolishness. And of course, anytime someone uses sarcasm like that, they're prone to being misunderstood. I can testify that constantly because, you know, if you make fun of a Bible interpretation, for example, some people think you're making fun of the Bible. You know, or you could see them misunderstanding Paul here. You're making fun of God, calling God's wisdom foolishness. That's sacrilegious. That's blasphemous. Well, again, they misunderstand. It's sarcasm to make a point that this is how the world sees it. That's the problem. It really is wisdom, and he'll explain that in the latter part of chapter 2. And then the leadership problem, again, the problem was reintroduced at the beginning of chapter 3, as we've seen. I'm of Apollos and Paul and Cephas and so on. And he's going to explain that true leadership is service, a servant mentality, just like Jesus served other people, put them higher than himself, and his needs, their needs coming before his. And then chapter 4 is going to be a specific application of those principles of chapter 3 to Paul personally, because it's not that Paul is a chip on his shoulder, and, oh, the Corinthians don't like me, and they're rejecting my apostleship, and so on. Paul understands, to the extent that his enemies are running him down, that undermines his authority as an apostle and undermines the message. And so the gospel is at stake. And so he has to defend himself, not for his own personal benefit, but for the sake of the gospel. And so in chapter 4, Paul will make that particular application. But that's, again, to come. We won't get there today, obviously. Our focus here is chapter 1, verse 18, through chapter 2, verse 5, which we had read and discussed some of this last time. But it really falls into three parts, where verses 18 through 25 is the real point. This summarizes the real issue. And then the other two sections are kind of supplementary. And so chapter 1, verse 26 through verse 31, here's the kind of people that the gospel appeals to and who come to the madness and the foolishness of God, because they come to see it for what it really is, true power and true wisdom. And then the first five verses of chapter 2, Paul talks about the method in which the gospel is preached. In particular, the manner in which he brought it to them was consistent with the nature of the gospel. And so if the gospel is all about a crucified Christ, how then could Paul come in as a preacher where it's, look at me, I'm a great orator with great persuasive skill, and I'm here to wow you and entertain you and so on. It's all about me. And the packaging detracts from the substance of the message. And if that's not relevant to today's society and even many Christians, that you sit there and say, well, what makes a good sermon? Or what makes a good Bible class? Well, if the person is flashy, maybe he dresses snazzy, or he tells a lot of jokes, or he's dynamic and exciting in his physical presentation. Oh man, he's a great preacher. Well, these things are desirable over being a dead cold fish. Doesn't give any indication he cares at all about what he's talking about, and completely unenthusiastic about the gospel message. But the main thing, it has to be the substance. And, there are just some preachers I know, if you sit down with a piece of paper to take notes of the substance of the message, you wind up with a blank sheet of paper when you're done. And someone else who may not be as, dynamic a speaker, he's going to give you some substance of some message. And it's the same thing of, it's human nature to want to eat, cake and ice cream and, all that's the superficial appealing stuff. But a steady diet of that is going to make you sick, because there's no real nutrition to that. Barry?
And you look at what's going on in society, just drive down the highway with these billboards from all these churches, and who's on the billboard? The star of the show.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, most church buildings have gone to a stage kind of presentation up front. There's no, it's not the lectern where a person stands and preaches and reads the Word of God and so on. It's a stage where the performance, takes place. Shane?
Well, I have there's a group of people that claim to worship God, and that's how they're set up. I mean, I do work for them on their computers and such, and they've got the whole, you walk in and it looks more like you stepped into a concert hall than where the preaching of God would be done. I mean, there's video walls, and there's, all this sound equipment, and there's, drums and stages. It's all about, the feel good, everything's, it's so little about, the true message of God. It's just how you feel when you're there, and if you feel good, then you'll want to come, and, maybe you'll pick up something about
right.
God while
right.
you're there, but,
right.
you'll at least feel good for, for a couple hours a week.
Yeah.
There was something else that you had said, and I can't help but think how they talked about how television changed how people elect presidents.
Mm.
The person, if they come up as a polished package, they people are more inclined to vote for them regardless of what they really know.
Right. 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 symbol over substance. Lawson?
The man came out of the service, turned to the preacher and said, "That was a really great sermon. You stepped on my toes."
Okay. You're saying that's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
That was a great play. I remember I invited a friend of mine when I was in high school to come to church, and she did. And when she walked in the church building, she said, "Well, what's that chalkboard doing up there, you know, on the pulpit?" And she'd never been in a church building, had a chalkboard, you know, up front. And of course, I didn't have a great experience going to other places, but yeah, I just thought, well, I guess it is a little bit different if you view what we're doing here as educational and to learn something, and it's a useful tool. Of course, these young people, chalkboard, what's that? You know. But anyway, let's just look through the text here again. I don't want to just reread all this to be rereading it, but I've color-coded it here so that the purplish color there has to do with wisdom or foolishness. And the blue part has to do with power and weakness. And then there's a kind of green color here that talks about the crucifixion, yellow that talks about the preaching of the word and things like that. But just to illustrate, there it is. So he says that I was sent to preach the gospel not in wisdom of word, so that the cross of Christ would not be emptied of its power. Now, the word power is not actually in verse 17, but we have to understand the cross being emptied. Well, what's it being emptied of? Well, clearly the idea is being emptied of its power. For the word of the cross is madness to those who are perishing, yet to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. And as Nathan pointed out, you would think the proper pair would be, you know, foolishness and wisdom. But no, it's foolishness and power. And the reason for that becomes apparent then when you look at verse 19, "For it is written," so he's going to quote a passage from the Old Testament. Now, how many passages in the Old Testament do you think you could find about the wisdom of God? Or the foolishness of man? Or if you want to go with the power part of it, the power and weakness. So there are hundreds of verses you could quote. But he chooses this verse, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart." And, you know, it's one of those things, again, where if you just read it through quickly, you don't realize the significance of what Paul has just said. You know, usually when you quote an Old Testament passage like this, you're proving your point. You're illustrating. Well, what's Paul illustrating? The word of the cross is madness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. What's my proof of that? Because God promised He is going to destroy the wisdom of this world. And He's not unpacking that whole argument for you. Clearly, what Paul is implying is the wisdom of God and the wisdom of this world are incompatible. So much so that one must destroy the other. And which way is it going to be? Well, the puny power of man is not going to destroy God. And man's so-called wisdom is not going to destroy God. But God's wisdom and power will destroy the wisdom of man. So God's wisdom is power, because His wisdom will destroy the wisdom of man. And so that's why it's appropriate to pair the foolishness and the power there. So where is the wise man? And that's a general term for, you know, the smart people, you know, the ones who profess to be the font of human wisdom. So where is the scribe? And that in particular would be a Jewish representative of that category of wise men. And where is the debater? And that would be a particularly Gentile character in that same category, which is in keeping with this Jew-Gentile contrast that kind of runs through the section. Has not God shown the wisdom of the world to be madness? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the madness of preaching to save those who trust. And it's possible to interpret verse 21 that the foolishness is the mechanism of preaching. that the method of its presentation, using people to preach it, is crazy. That's possible, but it seems most likely that what Paul means here is the content of the preaching, the message that's being preached, is what is really crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, he talks about the idea of Jesus dying on the cross as the stumbling block of the Jews, and it was foolishness to the Gentiles. Who ever heard of your Savior, you know, this King that's coming to earth to free you? You mean to tell me he came and died and didn't do a thing? Mm-hmm. You know, complete failure.
Right.
While he was here on the earth. Who ever
right.
heard of that?
Yeah. Weakness, shame, defeat.
Who would have ever thought that you know, you want this great hero, you know, a great hero is going to come and he's going to, you know, lift up armies and rally the people and they're going to, you know, take things over. And Jesus did the exact opposite.
Right.
I mean, none of us would ever choose that method.
Right.
So, I mean, to us, you know, I don't even like movies where the hero dies at the end of the movie.
I don't either.
You know, it's never been, you know, my thing. Even, you know, a big fan of John Wayne as I am, if he dies in the movie, it's not one of my ones I like to watch.
Right.
Because the hero's supposed to win in the end.
Right, right.
So we, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. That even further illustrates sort of the irony of it all. I mean, if you look at it from a prideful standpoint, what the Jews thought, like Shane said, you know, this is a king. He's going to establish this kingdom and establish Israel forever. Instead, he goes up there and dies, and then he says, in my father's house are many rooms. I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if you think, well, what does that mean, prepare a place? I don't really know, but typically, if somebody's going to be coming to visit, you're changing the sheets and making a bed. So not only did he die for us, now he's off someplace making a bed, making an abode for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is a humble position, a humble job, just making a home for us, someplace for you to stay. And that really does, I think it would, if somebody had that mindset of an earthly Jewish kingdom, now all of a sudden he's died and he's gone to make, you know, prepare a room for me.
And of course, the clincher to all this is Paul is not simply going to argue to them, you know, this is the religion we got stuck with. You know, the historical fact is our deity we worship was crucified and all these horrible things happen. He would have them to understand, of course, this was God's eternal purpose. This is the way it had to happen. Again, verse 19, God didn't simply set out to forgive people of their sins, but to destroy the very power that put them in sin, which was human wisdom. And so God has to destroy all that is human. And that's one of the things you see exemplified in Jesus, the complete destruction of all these things. But the implication of all of that, which he hasn't quite gotten to yet, is what does that mean for you? You don't simply look at the cross of Jesus from a distance and say, wow, that's kind of weird. Well, I didn't expect that. I was looking for a Messiah who was going to raise up an army and establish a human kingdom, but it turned out he came and got himself killed on a cross. Well, if that's God's plan, okay, I can live with that. No. To truly see the cross of Jesus is to realize it dawns on you, I've got to be crucified. And I've got to follow in this same path of defeat and misery and shame and humiliation. I'm supposed to sacrifice and suffer and serve people that don't deserve it. And that then is a message of absolute madness. As long as it's about Jesus, you know, it's really weird and bizarre. But as soon as you understand it's about you, it becomes completely unacceptable for most people. We cannot accept that degree of sacrifice and suffering and selflessness and service that's demanded of us. And that's why there are so few people interested in the true gospel of Jesus Christ. If you present the gospel to them that way, they'll say, no, thank you. Are you crazy? I don't want that.
One of the greatest fears and mysteries to man is death.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus solved that mystery. Mm-hmm. And by faith, we don't fear death anymore.
Right, right.
I remember a coworker of mine discussing where they were worshiping. I don't remember what two different denominations. They had switched denominations. And I'm like, well, why? I said, well, you know, we were going to this one place, and man, they had so many rules, and there were so many things that we had to do, and we found this other place, and over here, we can do all kinds of things. I mean, they had so much more freedom over what they could do when they worshiped with this group of people as opposed to the other one. So that was what they, you know, what they sought out, because this one gave them freedom, you know, freedom to do a whole lot more, you know, worldly things than what they could do in this other group. Yeah. They were just too stripped.
It's too bad you can't remember where that was.
No.
All right. Jews ask for signs of power. Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To Jews, a stumbling block; to Gentiles, madness. And that probably sums up the entire book right there. We preach Jesus Christ crucified. You know, that's what it is. And what does a crucified Christ mean? What is it telling you? Well, it's telling you everything of this world, everything that's merely of human origin, is worthless and destined for destruction and must be destroyed by God. And it's the problem, not the solution. And so anything that you're putting your spirituality in the basket of human accomplishment and oratorical ability or other things of human pride, those are the very things that God has set out to destroy. But more than that, again, you need to imitate this crucified Christ. And so to those who are the call, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the madness of God is wiser than men, the weakness of God is stronger than men. Well, as we indicated, this is illustrated now by the type of people that come to the gospel. Consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the mad things of the world to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, the base things of the world, and despised God has chosen. Indeed, the things that are not, the things that don't exist, the nobodies. See, we as Christians, do we see ourselves as nobodies? That's what Paul's saying here. We are nobodies. But God makes us somebody. But our attitude has to be one of humility, in which rather than seeing ourselves as some great successes and something to again take pride in human accomplishment, I'm a nobody. But God uses such nobodies to nullify the things that are, to illustrate who the true nobodies are. People who've put all their stock in wealth and their intelligence and their popularity and fame and political power. That's the real nobodyism, and that emptiness will be exposed for what it is under God's judgment, so that no man may boast before God. But by His doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that just as it is written, he who boasts must boast in the Lord. You know, that's where our boasting is. Well, who is the Lord? Well, the same crucified Christ that we preach. You're boasting in a crucified Lord, a crucified Christ. Well, again, that's ironic, boasting. The world would not truly call it boasting. You're boasting in your faith in a crucified Christ? That's not boasting. That's stupidity again. But that is our boast. We boast in our weakness. We boast in our nobodyism. We boast in our humbling ourselves, crucifying self to follow a crucified Christ. And then, that's what makes chapter 2 here, again, a bad chapter division. So, and when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of word or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ, indeed Jesus Christ crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your trust would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. Now, I don't think what Paul's saying is that the gospel is not persuasive. You know, that he didn't use persuasive, powerful words of preaching. He did. But it's not this kind of human oratorical ability. Rhetoric was just a big thing in the ancient world. And again, it was this symbol over substance type of thing. And I think Adam gave a great analogy of this. It's the kind of thing where we're all enamored of the tune of a song and how foot-tapping it is or whatever, but we're completely oblivious to the substance of the song, which may not exist or actually teaches error or any number of other problems with what the song is actually saying. Well, and the same thing with preaching. We don't really care about whether there's any content or any substance or whether the teaching is actually blatantly contradicting the Bible. As long as it's snazzy, as long as it's peppy, as long as it's, you know, exciting, it appeals to our fleshly instincts and so on. Now again, I hope that's not the case here, but there's certainly brethren who get caught up in that. So Paul brought a message of a crucified Christ, and his life and presentation was consistent with that same, it's not about me, it's about Christ, it's about humility and humbling ourselves to follow Christ. And that's probably what got Paul in a lot of trouble. You know, in the Corinthians' fleshly assessment of their leaders, how come Paul came out so poorly? Now, this isn't to bash Peter and Apollos, because they probably weren't party to all this nonsense going on in Corinth. There's no indication that the problem originated with them. But it's pretty clear that when they compared Paulus and Paul, Apollos came out a whole lot better than Paul did. Well, why? Well, if Paul intentionally was rejecting these kind of rhetorical flourishes, and maybe they came more naturally to Apollos, you know, not to blame him, but certainly Paul wasn't trying to use those things in order to impress the Christians. People just shake their head and say, well, you know, oh, Paul's okay, you know, he'll teach you the ABCs of the gospel, but if you really want to know the deep things and more profound things, you know, it's time to graduate on to, you know, someone like Apollos or something like that.
Well, I mean, we see, I mean, further, you know, into the study, or maybe in 2 Corinthians, I can't remember, he talks about, one of the complaints about him is that he doesn't speak with power when he's present.
Right.
He writes a great letter.
Right. Right.
The mighty man that he writes as. Right. one of the criticisms right. we see. So we don't know if he, you know, he may not have had a great speaking ability. We don't, I mean, I've heard people talk about maybe he was had vision problems and other things that would maybe make him not as visually appealing when people were looking at him.
Right.
Who knows? But
yeah.
All of these physical factors.
Right. And that is in 2 Corinthians. And you know, I do get the impression that, you know, when Paul was personally present with people, he was acting in a humble way and trying to deal with their problems in a more patient kind of way and so on. But when you're writing someone a letter, there's only so much beating around the bush you can do. And you're rebuking somebody, and that's going to come across as, on paper, pretty direct, no matter how much padding you do to it. So, I mean, we're familiar with that. You know, you say the same thing in an email that you say in person to somebody, and you're more likely to be misunderstood in the email, and the tone of it is, you know, perceived as more harsh or something like that. Well, we'll see how much in, well, we'll just skip this. We kind of already covered that. So chapter 2, verses 6 through 16, which unfortunately we're not going to get able to look at here in any great detail, but the wisdom of the Corinthians here, you know, the reason Paul uses the word wisdom so much is probably because that was the word the Corinthians were using. They were talking about wisdom and how they're so wise and they're pursuing wisdom and so on. And so that's why Paul writes the letter and says, well, you want to talk about wisdom? Let me tell you about wisdom. There's something even better than your wisdom, and that's the foolishness, the madness of God. And that becomes his preferred term. And so clearly Paul is using the word wisdom in a negative way, a pejorative way throughout the entire section. But now he begins using it in a positive sense. He had used it a little bit positively earlier, but now he develops it even more so here in chapter 2. And the irony of this again is the wisdom, the true wisdom of God is the wisdom of this crucified Christ, which we had already talked about. Back in chapter 1, that I preach Christ crucified, and chapter 2, verse 2, I would preach nothing but Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And so the problem then is these spiritual Corinthians are not spiritual at all. And the wise Corinthians don't possess true wisdom at all. And so it's an ironic situation. And so much like the world views the cross as madness, the Corinthians were in danger of seeing the cross that way and not fully recognizing what the cross means for them. And so, well, we'll just have to stop here, unfortunately. I'll tell Nathan we really didn't cover anything. Pick up in chapter 2, verse 6 anyway. Read through this section and you can see Paul's argument. And in particular, and you'll see this when he gets into chapter 3 as well, he uses three different terms to describe people. What some of your translations will say, the natural man. This is the word psychikos, which is from the Greek word psyche. We get words like psychology and so on from that. It's the soul. So literally you would call it the soulish man versus the spiritual man. And the distinction that's being made there is even squirrels have souls. It's the life force that animates them and makes them scurry, you know, in the street before they no longer have a soul. Well, if a man is living this animal existence and not being spiritual, then he's really no better than a squirrel. And so that's the natural man. That's the unspiritual man. It's the soulish man versus the one who has the Spirit of God and bears the fruit of the Spirit. But then when you get to chapter 3, he starts talking about the fleshly men. The people of the world are mere animals. They don't have the Spirit. But Paul couldn't say that about the Corinthians because they did have God's Spirit. But that didn't mean they were spiritual. They were still fleshly. And so he uses the word fleshly or carnal to describe the Corinthians. So look for that distinction as you look through that section and see if that'll help you make sense of some of the things Paul has said. But, yeah.